Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule and my guest for tonight is John Misnikowski. Fine artist John Misnikowski pays keen attention to his subject, working always from life. His aim is to resolve the work of art within the classical idiom. John received his art education at the University of Buffalo and the Cranbrook Art Academy in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. He's had a long career as an arts educator at such institutions as the University of Buffalo, McMaster University, and Sheridan College. He has completed numerous public commissions for the National Research Council of Ottawa, the Banting Museum of the Canadian Diabetes Association in London, the Rainer Gardens, London, McMaster University, the City of Owen Sound, the City of Guelph, and the Town of Hepworth, including bronze portraits of such notable Canadians as Margaret Atwood, David Suzuki, George Grant, and Nobel Prize winner Gerhard Hertzberg. Misnikowski's work is in many private and public collections, including the Birchfield Penny Art Center in Buffalo, the Art Gallery of Hamilton, the Tom Thompson Gallery, McMaster University, Hamilton Club, and Mount Sinai Hospital. Welcome to Art Waves, John Misnikowski.
Yes. Far away.
Okay, what brought you to Canada and what has caused you to stay?
Well, actually, my father was born in Hamilton, 1910, 1911, I'm not sure which, and was here until 1914, which means that I have relatives in Hamilton, quite a few. Well, very few left now, but when I immigrated in 66, I had quite a few. And my wife, who I married in 1964, was Canadian. She was from St. Catharines. And in 1966, when I left graduate school, I got a job teaching a summer course, a very important summer course at the McMaster University. So for all those reasons, I came. Needless to say, the draft was also a kind of incentive.
Well, sure. So the Vietnam draft was happening at that time, of course, and you would have been eligible given your age and so forth.
Very much. Okay.
So once you came, were you ever tempted, for example, to take the amnesty for the draft dodgers, as they were called, for the conscientious objectors and go back? Or did you just want to stay in Canada by then?
No, I always had a feeling that I would want to be a Canadian. I liked the notion of a borderless North, which you don't have in the States. And I was never tempted to travel through the United States for some reason. I really wanted to be Canadian, and maybe that's why I married a Canadian. I'm not sure.
Yeah, very, very interesting that you had that sense from a young age. And of course, with your having relatives here, you were very aware. But you were being brought up in Buffalo, were you?
Lackawanna.
Lackawanna, New York. Okay, yes. So not far from the border anyway.
No.
And did your dad know that you came to Canada? Did he live into that part of your life?
Oh, yes. He lived till he was in his 90s. So.
Oh, great.
Now, he always wanted me to go back, but I never did ever entertain that notion at all, ever.
Okay, so how old were you, John Misnikowski, when you knew that you wanted to make a life in art?
Well, I would say that there's a difference between art and the notion of drawing, painting. Now, I was a violinist, and music was very important to me as a young person. But by the age of, now this will shock you maybe, by the age of 3 or 4, I had already embarked on a plan to understand what I saw and interpret it. Now, I could give you examples of this, but it sounds ridiculous.
Please do.
Well, when I was, it would be 3 years old. I was born in 43, and in 46, some of my uncles were coming back from the war. I had quite a few in-laws that way, but in one case, I had one uncle, since he had a beautiful uniform, and I could see that, I had him sit for me. And I was 3 years old. I actually had him sit at the table and I drew him with great seriousness. And my mother said that I paid particular attention to the buttons on his coat. And a year later in 47, my father bought a car. It was one of the first cars available after the war. And my brother and I saw it arrive in front of our house, and we were on a second floor balcony. So I was kind of looking down at an oblique angle. And my brother, who is 2 years older and therefore full of wisdom, corrected me. I said to my brother, look, Dad has bought a one-door car. And my brother said, no, Yash, it's two doors. There's a door on the other side. And that absolutely stunned me. And I had to go back to my drawing boards and that and redo all the drawings of vehicles that I had already constructed. And they all then looked as if they'd been stepped on by an elephant so that I could see both sides at one time. And it never left me. I was always confident that I could draw, I could understand if I applied. By the time I was in fifth grade, I had copied skeletons out of my parents' encyclopedia, which impressed the most bright girl in the class, and I was pleased with that. And by the time I was 11, 12 years old, I could draw a perspective quite easily and imagine the vehicles I drew, being able to get into them and escape Lackawanna.
I love that answer, John Mznikowski. That's terrific. Okay, so from the age of 3 or 4, you were using art as a way to understand the world around you.
Yes, it was funny, but I always, I'll give you an example of comparison and contrast. And I used comparison and contrast throughout my entire career. But again, I was about, I was 4 years old. My father got this car. And they also gave me a drawing board. It was slate and it had a roll on it, a paper roll. And on it, there was a drawing lesson or a series of lessons from drawing an egg to a battleship. You can remember this is 46, 47, right? So battleships and that were really great. Well, it showed an automobile and it would be a pre-war car. And in those days, in the 30s, vehicles were generally built so that the hood of the motor was separate from the lights. They were in their own nuclei and they were mounted on the fenders and then the bumper was separate and so on, the tire underneath. And in the lesson, it showed one single fat line describing all of these individual bits and pieces. When I went downstairs to view my father's new car and he was washing it one day, I said I was going to draw it. To my astonishment, one big fat line did not describe what I saw. And I knew that the lesson was an error. And I paid particular attention to drawing the fender separate from the wheel, not with one big fat line, but with different lines. And in that sense, I think it was pretty advanced for my age in terms of dealing with this issue of drawing.
Oh my gosh, yes. Amazing, really. That's fascinating. And I never thought about the business of the headlights being down on the bumper before, but you're right, that those older cars were like that. Do you remember the make of car your father had bought?
Oh gosh, yes. I'm a car nut. It was a 1947 Ford, a two-door. And there's still some of them around, but I knew my vehicles. My brother and I could identify cars with lightning speed. We were well-educated American boys.
That's right. It was a key to life in the States, wasn't it? For sure. Yeah. Okay, so can you talk about starting to have formal lessons, or did you ever have formal lessons aside from your drawing board instruction?
No, I actually went to college for violin first. And okay. Thank God within the first 2 or 3 days realized I could never cut out to be a violinist. I didn't have adequate instruction. And in a city of 40,000 people that made up Lackawanna, I think I was the only child in the school systems that played the violin. So I did not have proper education. I did not have proper experience. And it took me 2 days, I think, to realize when I did go to a music school that I was not cut out to be that, and fell back immediately on my other love, and that was the visual arts. And from there, when I went back home, I went to the University of Buffalo, which had just absorbed the Albright Knox Art School. In fact, I applied to the Albright Knox and was ushered into the University of Buffalo, and there discovered my real true love. It was like coming home.
Okay, and there you did have teachers that you could see were going to give you what you needed.
Well, yes, one didn't know what one needed. It was all this grand mystery, a rather beautiful mystery. But I did have some very talented teachers, one in particular. He was a sculptor instructor, and his name was Roy Hendrickson. And he was very large, very handsome. He could have been a movie star, and that was just what I needed to emulate this movie star. And he was sensitive. He was extremely sensitive and knowledgeable in an intuitive way. And he gave us one day an example by doing the model. He actually modeled it, the sitter. And in those 2 hours, I discovered what art was all about. And I should never forget it. And I think I have tried to emulate him in a way ever since.
So you say in those 2 hours, you discovered what art was about. Was it the first time? It wasn't the first time you'd drawn someone from life. You did that at 3 years old. What was it about the experience that taught you everything that you needed?
Well, what he did was he ignored exactly what the model looked like. And what he attempted to do, and he did very successfully, for I can still remember it in my mind, is that he translated her into form, into a formal issue. And that formal issue expressed not only the sitter, but his own intelligence. And I swear I could remember that. I had a feeling that Roy expressed himself, and I knew him from then on. He showed who he was in terms of his intelligence, his sense of aesthetics, and so on. It was really quite a beautiful head. And it was very, very simple. It was something so abstract that I could not do it, and I couldn't do it now.
He did an abstract of this person, this head.
Well, it wasn't an abstraction. It was a simplification. What he did was he actually brought out the formal aspects of her head, what her proportions were, what the shapes were, if you reduce them to their essence. In other words, he established the truth about the model, not all the filigree and add-ons, such as, you know, individual shapes and so on.
Okay.
But do you follow?
Yes. Is this what you mean, John Misnikowski? Is this what you mean when you say in your bio that your aim is to resolve the work of art within the classical idiom?
Yes, the form is definitely within the classical rules. For the Greeks, as far as I'm concerned, didn't invent art, but they discovered it. They discovered what was in our heads. And what they discovered was, for me in those days, absolutely exciting beyond belief. It was as if I, like I say, as if I came home. In my entire life, I never felt I understood what was going on around me in that sense. But when I went to art school and I had some of these people, these instructors, and some of the exposure I had to art itself through the Albright Knox, I felt like I was finally home.
Wow, that's absolutely wonderful. Now, I asked you about memorable teachers and also mentors. Were you the first person in your family to be so drawn to art, as it were?
Yes, my parents were not artistic. My brother said it this way when I was about 18. He said to me, Yash, he said, Yash, by the way, is Yashu, which is a kind of a warm sense of Janek, which is Polish for John. He said, Yash, you have a bee in your bonnet. I do not. And he still doesn't.
So he didn't want to take up any kind of passionate activity to make his living by.
No, Degas put it this way, and he put it quite well. He said that the gulf between an artist and his family is unbridgeable. And I absolutely believe it. My father never understood art, visual, audible, or otherwise. My mother had a little clearer sense, but she rejected the whole thing as being not real enough. And my brother simply is mystified.
Okay. Now, mostly John Misnikowski, I've seen your sculptures and your drawings. Do you also paint? Do you do other media? And what would you say is your favorite medium or genre of art?
Well, painting horrors, no. I leave that to those who are capable, Catherine. But I did sculpture. I drew with clay. I loved clay. And by the way, when I was 6 years old, my father built a house and there was bricks lying all around the place and dirt. And I remember gathering up and no one told me anything about this. Somehow or another, it was in my noggin from the beginning. I built a kiln and fired my little clay pots with leaves and sticks. And you know, I can still remember what it looked like and how I constructed it. And yet it worked. I had a sense of the thing. But no, it's clay. It was clay, always clay. And plaster and clay. I loved plaster also. And the bronze. And it all aimed towards finally pouring bronze. you know, I came out of that I can connect with as far as my past in terms of a broader field. In terms of the art, no, but materials, yes. The world I came out of was not artistic in the slightest. And where I got these ideas to do these things as a young person, very young, and then reconnect with it when I was older, I do not know. It was always somehow there. Strangely enough, you know, Life magazine, of all things, we used to get every Friday, would carry reproductions of the old masters. And I became acquainted with many of the old masters through Life magazine.
Mm.
There was also a huge basilica, which was half the size of St. Peter's. It was a reproduction of St. Peter's within sight and within hearing of our house in Lackawanna. It's called Our Lady of Victory Basilica. And it contained, when I went back, I counted over 100 marble sculptures of all sorts. And as a child, I can remember touching them, feeling them, seeing them, watching them every Sunday as I was forced to go to church, and gaping at the paintings and so on. So that it was natural for me to think that this was normal, that this was something that I could do and that I would want to do and so on. So, you know, the strangest connections caused me to do what I'm doing. It's not, there was nothing normal about my upbringing, et cetera, in that way.
Okay. John Misnikowski, you've talked about the first time you tried to draw, and it was your uncle in his uniform, his war uniform. And yep. You knew right away that it was a portrait that you wanted to make, it sounds like. So with sculpting, you have actually mostly done portraiture, it seems to me. When was the first time you attempted to make a statue that was a likeness of a person and not just like a pot or something?
Well, when I went to the Albright Knox Art School, the University of Buffalo, it was fortunately still remnant of the 19th century educational system. It was still intact when I started. And so you took painting, sculpture, drawing, dimensional, three-dimensional design, two-dimensional design. In other words, it was a basic program that they offered with various quality teachers involved, but still it was all there. And one of the things we had to do in sculpture was create a figure. So that was the first time.
All right, so if you've just tuned in, listeners, this is Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule. My guest tonight is the fine artist, John Misnikowski. So John Misnikowski, let's keep talking about this idea of a portrait in clay or bronze or plaster, because to me that seems to be a kind of the ultimate portrait because it's three-dimensional, but also perhaps extremely difficult, as it certainly would be for me. You have been commissioned to make statues of such notables as Margaret Atwood, George Grant, David Suzuki, people that we know very, very well, their household names and actually household images in Canada. If you messed up, people would know it right away. They would be like, oh, that's not what Margaret Atwood looks like. You know, this is just kind of a strenuous task, it seems to me, to make public art of this kind. Did they sit for you? You always work from life. How did you go about doing this?
Margaret Atwood was one of the first commissions I had, and I had to chase her for a year, practically a year. She would not sit. She would sit. She agreed to do it. It was for McMaster University, for their library, actually. A man by the name of William Reedy commissioned it. He was the head librarian. But Atwood would not actually sit. She felt, she said to me that contemporary artists cannot do portraiture anymore. And so I had to deal with that. And I finally got ahead of her after many starts and many errors with something that I thought was expressive of her. And it was agreed upon by the other faculty members, et cetera, that it was in fact her. And the head still is at the McMaster Art Gallery. It's a good head. But I did later on, I did another one of David Suzuki. Now that was a different commission. That was the man who taught David Suzuki genetics at UBC, was in fact the head of the biology department. His name was Stephen Threkeld. And Threkeld actually taught my wife. She had gone to McMaster before I met her as a biology student. So there was all these connections. And he lived quite close to me too, out in the rural parts of around Hamilton. And at that time, I was feeling my oats and I really could go like fury. And I would do two heads at one time, And this is important. This is really important for me, and I think for understanding the notion of creating art. And you'll know it as a writer or poet. And that is that I would work two heads at one time. In other words, I would start with one armature and build up the image until my brain would stop. I would run out of ideas. I would then put it aside and start a second one. This within, say, 45 minutes or an hour. And I would now have started a route, a way of traveling, as it were, to him. And I would do the second one until, again, the same thing happened. I would run out of ideas and I would stop. I would then compare, and this is the crucial thing. I would compare the second one with the first one. And invariably, the second one always took the first one further, refined it, redefined it. And therefore, I would take the first one apart, for it was now useless, that it did its function. And I would start a third one. And again, run out of ideas on the third, compare the second with the third, and the comparison would tell me where I was going. And I did, in David Suzuki's case, seven heads in one afternoon. It was, I think it astounded everybody. It exhausted me totally. But I got a very, very good head of him. And at the end, by the time the seventh head arrived, I could have done it with my knee and my elbow. I didn't use my hands. I knew exactly where to put the clay and what to do with it. And I have a feeling that I still do that. When I'm drawing, I still am not satisfied with the first, and I do a second drawing and a third drawing. And the second one tells me what the third one should be and blah, blah, blah. Same thing.
So this is the comparison contrast that you mentioned earlier.
Yes, exactly. I think we know everything by comparison and contrast. We don't know anything really by just viewing or listening or anything else. Can I make a little side thing about music here?
Please do.
Catherine's father, Tom McDonald, had an amazing record collection of which I had access to. It was incredible. He had about 500 to 600 records, classical records. And he was very astute in terms of his choosing of pianists, etc. And in one case, I got a hold of a record that was a classic. And it was Vyacheslav Richter's playing of Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition. He did it in 1957, I think, in Sofia, Bulgaria, of all places. And it was a smash hit. And I listened to it over and over and knew it by heart. And then some years later, I found another record in Tom's collection. And that was pictures at an exhibition, but this time by Benno Moiseevits. And Benno Moiseevits did a totally different approach. And to my astonishment, I ended up so preferring it, I couldn't listen to the Richter. Richter actually made Mussorgsky into Richter. And Moiseevits turned the music into Mussorgsky's. And to me, that's an extremely important lesson. And here you have, of course, a comparison and contrast. You could compare the two, and one will reveal itself as true and the other not. And mm-hmm. The same thing, I had records of Haydn sonatas by Vyacheslav Richter. And again, I thought I knew Haydn's sonatas. And then I came across of other records, again, revealed in Catherine's vast library of her father's. And it was a man by name of Arthur Balsam, rather unknown, but very important in the 30s and 40s, especially. And he played in a way which revealed Haydn. So for the first time, instead of hearing Richter, I heard Haydn. And yet, at the same time, Balsam was not just simply reproducing Haydn, but he brought out the truth of Haydn. And in the same way, when an artist has a person sit in front of him, that person is the piece of music. And what his job is to interpret that piece, that notation, as it were, except in this case, the notation is flesh and blood, into form. So that's, do you follow?
Yeah, I see it. I see what you're talking about. Yes. And so it always seems to me that the best portraits, you feel like you know the person who's being depicted. You know their something about their character, or at the very least, their mood.
Oh, absolutely. But as it said, some person said, you know, a portrait is the merging of two people on one canvas. And I believe that totally. If someone sits for me, I just don't look at them. I become them. And I do it unconsciously. And this is not, I'm trying to not try to sound like I'm something super special. but I really empathize. And I invent even stories about them in my own head. They may be true or false, I don't know. But the point is that I am connected with them in all kinds of ways. And then I can see them more and more clearly. And if I do them several times, the clarity becomes sharper and basically more exciting and wonderful.
Well, you know, Catherine's daughter, Ray Bates, who is another artist in the family, the remarkable family, she says that there are three people involved in a portrait because the viewer will be there as well. So there's the artist, and there's the sitter, and then there's also the presumed audience in the future. And I agree with that as a broadcaster. You know, I feel that it'd be totally different if you and I were sitting in a room talking, but we know that people are going to be listening to this conversation, and that makes a difference to shaping how we speak. It maybe makes us a little more classical, a little more formal, possibly. But I thought that was a wonderful insight of Ray's.
Yes, that actually alludes to a description of Baroque music, that there was a triad. There was the composer, God, and the audience. And, and they all connected. I'm a little more cynical in this case. I'm trying to make an image which has a sense of truth about it, like my old instructor, Roy Hendrickson, did on that head, to, in a way, show the person who or she really is, not, you know, on a multiple of levels. And to me, an audience would have to be sophisticated, intelligent, and have the time to look and not just gaze upon a cross, you know, and then go on. And I don't know, I'm rather dubious about the whole process. I think
it's... Well, we know that our Art Waves audience is all of those good things. So.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Now, John Misnikowski, you also did a portrait of George Grant. But that when he was still alive, were you able to?
Oh, yes, 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 no. I have a wonderful story. I was, at that time, I had a little Mini. I drove Minis in the, I always drove odd cars. And he was in the car. He filled the car up. And I said something, and I must have said something off about, because he was very Christian. And he yelled at me to stop the car, stop the car. I couldn't imagine. He said, John, he said, you're blasphemous. Let me out of here. And I had to coax him back into the car so that he could continue our ride to my house and I would do his head. And I got a very nice head of him. And he liked it very much.
And how long does it take you on average to do a head?
Well, that depends. It really depends. When I did Hertzberg, Hertzberg wrote something very nice in his, there's a biography of him, and there's some two pages of pictures of I and he with the bronze head. And it's a presentation at the National Research Council. And he wrote that he was surprised at how tenacious I was, that I wasn't just satisfied with the first, second, or third. In fact, I think it was the sixth. He traveled from Ottawa three times or four times. He flew in and sat in my awful car garage. And I drove several times up to his house in Ottawa. So that took a long time. But the product that you end up with, if you call it a product, should hide all that, should not show that at all.
You not show labor, right.
No, your viewer shouldn't be labored with your labor, right. Or belabored with your labor.
Good point.
So it varies.
It varies, of course. The length would vary depending on the project and the person. But John Misnikowski, do you think that it's important you know the person well, or does that make it harder to do a good portrait?
No, it doesn't matter whether you know the person well. Like I say, you connect with them. You become intimate with them. You form stories about them in your own head. It just doesn't mean that you know who they are. It'd be like a writer seeing a person on the street, et cetera, and they form an opinion that this person may be in their novel, et cetera. And they spin a life around them, but they're not. It's not necessarily true.
Right.
So, no, I don't need to.
Do you ask your sitters, your models, to be quiet while you work on them or to talk?
That depends. Sometimes the conversation flows freely and then I really knuckle down. If there's something that truly gets me involved, I'll shut up and then they shut up. They notice I don't respond. But I think, no, it's very different from person to person. But, you know, I will say this, children are very easy to do. Adults can hide very easily. They can hide by fluctuating their muscles through various emotional states that they go into. And they're going into these emotional states as basically as a hiding mechanism. So what you're looking at, it's constantly changing and can be very difficult. Children, on the other hand, they are who they are, and they're as easy as falling off a log. And I will say one other thing. When you do sculpture, there is no perspective in sculpture, none. So you form an imaginative capacity, which is much different than the one you would form if you were drawing or only painting. So in sculpture, I form the ability to, and this is not unusual, I form the ability to put the person into my head and flip them around, kind of like a computer image. And I could see them from upside down, even though I was looking at them from right side up. In drawing, however, it's all perspective. It's all from your point of view. And there, the sitter has to cooperate much more. When I did children's sculpture, they could jump around the room for all their worth, like using the furniture as a gym set. And it didn't bother me at all. In fact, the parents would always say, "How did you get little Johnny? He was just jumping around all day." And it would be, well, because I had developed this business of looking where I wanted, getting the information, putting it into my head. And it was kind of like fishing. You know, you sit there and you wait. You wait until you see what you want, and then you get on with it. But when a person sits to be drawn, it can be very irritating if the person starts to move slightly because it follows you up. You think you understand the perspective, and then suddenly you're aware now that it was all an error, or you think it's an error. So there's quite a bit of difference between the two.
Fascinating, John Misnikowski. I could listen to you talk all day. Now, it's an impossible question, I know, but I'd like to hear you say something about the impact moving to Canada had on you as an artist, as a person, whatever. You have said artistic expression finds fulfillment in the viewer, in culture, as it is being lived. Do you think that you or your work would be different had you stayed in the States?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, in a strange way, I don't think I would have had the blessed ignoring that I have had in Canada. It allows you to, in a sense, investigate your own issues, not other people's issues. When I went to graduate school, it was Cranbrook. There was this huge kind of push towards technique, towards all kinds of issues that I really, although I was interested in the bronze casting, to say the least, I was really interested in it. But, you know, everybody was doing something different. And I had no feeling for that. And yet I had the feeling that I should be. But when I came to Canada, I could kind of get on with it on my own level and my own speed. I will say this, though, the shift in terms of teaching was enormous. When I went to the schools in the States, the subject was the important thing. The individual, not so important. In fact, almost no importance. But it was the subject. When I came to Canada, it was the student. It was the person. We live in a very person-oriented society. And It took me 10 years to, in a sense, come to terms with that. I would always say that I was indifferent to their work. But actually, I was just interested in their work. They didn't like that. They wanted me to be interested in them. Big difference.
Very, very interesting. Who are some of your favorite artists, John Misnikowski, and why?
Oh, there's a whole group we put here. I enjoyed the Italian artists, contemporary 20th century. There is a group, but you know, all of them started before the Second World War. And by the time the 60s and 70s came along, in which the United States now dominated the art world, they had lost it as far as I'm concerned. They lost their roots. There was people like Manzu, who I think was brilliant at the beginning, just amazing. And he ended up being a showman. There was Marini, Marino Marini, again, phenomenal sensitivity, an amazing interpreter of the human form. And he ended up, a friend of mine actually worked for him. And he said that when Marini reached the age of 80 and he was into abstractions, he simply wouldn't get out of bed. And when people tried to get him out of bed, he simply said, basta, and he died in bed. It had enough of the art world. And there was people like Martini. Martini, I think, was revolutionary and very, very important to modern sculpture. And then before him, there was people like Madame de Rosso. And Rosso was an impressionist and an amazing man for redefining what form could be in sculpture. And then before him, of course, Rodin. And then before him, people like Jericho and Pigalle and Houdon. Yeah, Carpo. Oh, yes, Carpo. So these were French. But the French, I think, in the 20th century, except for Maillol, did not interest me at all. But, you know, all of these people shared so much, the language, the classical language, which isn't just classical. It is somehow indicative of the way we think in poetry. If you ask me what art was, and you haven't asked me what I thought art was yet, I would say this: art is poetic. Art is poetry. Art is made by people who are poetic, and how they express that feeling inside of them, that bee in their bonnet, as my brother had described to me, takes many forms. And when the teaching should come, the teaching should provide a technique and a format in which that bee in the bonnet can be realized. That's all it is. And there's very, very few people who have that bee in their bonnet. Very few who have that poetic impulse. I always had it. You live a life, you live a double life almost. You have the life of your feelings and the life that you have to contend with around you. And like I say, as a kid, I grew up in Lackawanna, and I surely didn't have any sensibility towards the city I was involved with. But when I went to art school, suddenly there it was, I was home. I could connect with and communicate with all these people that I just mentioned.
Yes, and that was close to you. It wasn't very far that you had to go to find that.
No, it was wonderful. The Albright Knox opened its doors again. It had been rebuilt in 1958, 59, 60, up to 64. And when I went to school in 60, they had just opened it up and their collection increased, and they had some beautiful pieces. And I always felt that when I went into an art gallery at that time, I was entering almost a sanctuary, an intellectual and emotional sanctuary. And it gave me great sense of peace and relief.
Yes.
I wish I could feel it now.
Feel it now. Well,
yes.
What is stopping you from feeling it?
Well, I don't have a gallery. I can't get a gallery. I belong to no gallery. So I have no actual public connection. I do have pieces out in the public, but the connection there is very thin, very, very thin.
Why do you think it is that you can't get into a gallery?
A friend of mine, this was back in the 70s, 80s, back in the 80s, he was a painter, and we both had the same gallery, Gadassi Gallery at that time. And so he lived only a block away from me up north near Owen Sound. It was a real coincidence. And he taught at George and Bay Collegiate, whatever they called it. And he had access to all the equipment to make reproductions and photographs and so on. And what he did was he spent an entire year making this phenomenal brochure of his work. He then spent an entire summer, when he got this all compiled, driving throughout Ontario and Quebec, showing every single private and public gallery he could his work. When he came back, I'd never seen anyone so angry, so pissed off. He said he can't remember one director of any of these institutions who asked to look at his wonderful portfolio. They only asked him who he had shown with, who recommended him, had he received any awards, blah, blah, blah. They didn't look at his work.
At the work, yeah. I see.
It says it all.
Yeah, that says it all. I get the idea. That's tragic. That's terrible. I was going to ask where people can see your work. You've mentioned that you have pieces at the McMaster Art Gallery and so on. Do you have a website, John Misnikowski?
No, I don't believe in it. I think you get lost. You get lost like a tree in the woods. And also, sculpture, it's flat. All the reproductions that you get are flat, and sculpture is not flat. And so the essential issue is lost. Drawings, no, but even then, I can't. I don't have the time and the energy. I don't have the energy, basically, anymore.
Okay, so there is no gallery that represents you in that sense?
No.
Not even the Carnegie?
Oh, I've shown at the Carnegie a number of times, but I am not a member. I've just moved to this area now.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about living up in Hepworth and near Owen Sound and all. You seem to have a lot to do with that area. What was it about that area that caused you to live there?
Well, to begin with, I first went up there in 76, 77. The property was inexpensive, and it was very freewheeling as far as building whatever you wanted to. And so I bought a piece of property, beautiful, and it's absolutely gorgeous up there. Mm-hmm. And it was a knockout, and I built a house. I built it myself, and I built a foundry, a large one, and used it as such. And with no restrictions, no rules that I would have had to follow making anything close to Hamilton.
I see.
So that I could not have done what I did up there here. It was impossible.
Okay, I see. And it is, as you say, it is so beautiful there that I don't have any question about why you would want to live there in terms of its beauty, but it is far from the centers of art and commerce, as it were. So, but people know you and they know your work, so.
I think growing up as a child, loving Mendelssohn, Bruckner, these are the things I used to listen to, the violin concertos of these people before I went to bed. My parents were mystified, gave me the idea that art was really something you occupied yourself with. And in a way, I think that held through so that I could be up there. Yes, I realized the isolation, but at the same time, I could get on with it. I still got a sufficient number of commissions and did some pieces that not all of them I'm proud of, but there are.
Well, I do want to ask, you know, what is one of your favorite pieces that you've done?
Well, actually, my favorite piece is in my bedroom. It's a wooden piece I carved the first year it was in Canada. I lived in a place called Sarnia. My wife taught at the collegiate in Sarnia. And I occupied myself for an entire winter carving this large piece of elm, which was nonsensical. I didn't know anything about wood, but I carved this very large life-size figure in wood. And it taught me everything I then used in terms of my teaching career. I mean, Roy Hendrickson taught me what art was, but to actually deal with the reality of making a piece out of wood taught me everything.
Mm-hmm. Wow, love it. All right, John Misnikowski, what do you think art does for a society? You've talked about what it can do for the artist.
I'll give you a little story again. I love telling stories. When I was doing Gerhard Hertzberg, and here is the Nobel Prize winner of Canada, most, you know, celebrated Canadian at that year, it was 72, 73. And I had a Mini at that time. Again, I said, and I always was driving these illustrious people around in this little steel bucket. And I went to his house and he said, John, I have to go to the science library. Could you give me a ride in? So off we went. And he said, oh, John, go down this road. Go to this intersection. So we went there. And there at the intersection was a pile of steel plates that were dumped. It was a public piece. Then he told me to go to another intersection and it looked like plastic kidneys, giant plastic kidneys. You could see through them. And then we finally went to a wall of lucite, which contained all bits and pieces of garbage. And I said to him, Gerhard, I said, allay your fears. I said, the pigeons will find us. And like statues of Queen Victoria, they will poop on it to the point where no one will see it. he got very upset. I always had these brilliant, gonna get really upset at me. He said, John, this is not a joking issue. And he said, if this is the art of our times, we are in a culture of bees and ants. And by the way, he had to take his break at some points to have his voice lesson. He loved Lieder, he loved opera. And so the 72-year-old man would, for an hour, go through the lesson with an instructor.
Yeah, that is amazing. Very interesting. So obviously you feel that it's a pity sometimes the way some kinds of art seem to reflect the society.
Yes, but their worth in that reflection is dubious.
Yeah. So we have to wrap this up. It has been absolutely a fascinating hour. I can't believe how quickly it's gone, John Misnikowski, but I shouldn't have been surprised because I know you're a good storyteller. What piece of music have you chosen for us to close Art Waves with tonight, and why did you choose that one?
Well, I chose Benno Mircievicz because I love the way he deals with the composers. He is always honest with them. He never tries to impose himself. Yet his interpretation of their music has a lightness to it, especially in the bass line, by the way. If you listen to piano music, he's marvel at the bass line. It's always light, and it always has a very, very wonderful ring to it. And so I chose Baccarat by Chopin in F. I think it's in F major. It's a marvelous piece of music. It's long, so you can trail it off anytime you want. Play the first 3 minutes, and it's enough.
Well, I am absolutely delighted you chose Chopin. I had Dr. Alan Walker on the show, and he did his wonderful biography of Chopin. Have you had a chance to read that, by the way?
No. I have difficulty reading. It's interesting. Catherine, just one little thing. Catherine says that her father had exactly the same problem. I read, my eyes tire enormously, but I can draw for 2 hours straight without my eyes tiring. And it's because I'm constantly shifting from here to there, from here to there. When you read, you read at one distance, and the muscles give way at that. So I don't read all that much. I read poetry, by the way.
Oh, very good. That's always a good thing to do.
And I try to memorize it, but I won't burden you with that one.
Well, that is actually also a very good thing to do for your brain as we age. It only remains for me to say thank you so much, John Misnikowski, for being on Art Waves tonight. It's been a delight.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, and we always thank our listeners for tuning in as well, and we hope you can join us next week at 7 p.m. on 101.5 The Hawk for another installment of these fascinating conversations with Hamilton artists. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario.